Mr. Yudashin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Gary Yudashin. I represent Mr. Mills on this case. I have multiple points that we've raised on appeal, but I want to really focus on three different points for purposes of the oral argument. Excuse me. Initially, I'd like to talk about the motion to suppress, then talk about the sufficiency of the evidence, and then discuss one of our sentencing issues. The motion to suppress came about as a result of the investigation of this case by the Plano police and the DEA. This was an MDMA distribution case in the Dallas and Collin County area. The police made undercover buys, and essentially what happened was they would make an undercover buy from one of the members of the alleged conspiracy, make an arrest of that person, and then immediately offer that person the opportunity to cooperate with the police by calling somebody else to come over and engage in a drug transaction. And multiple people did this over and over again, and eventually it led them to Lamon Donnell, who was the supplier of all of the people who had initially cooperated with the police. The same thing would happen with Donnell, where the police made an arrest on him and offered him an opportunity to cooperate if he would lead them to somebody else. And he said that Gary Mills was going to make a transaction, do a transaction with him. And then the police had him go ahead and call Mills and make arrangements to meet Mills at a shopping center. And then Mills came to the shopping center. And when Mills came there, the police immediately arrested him. And when they arrested him, they found a gun in his waistband, a bag with, I believe, about $20,000 in cash. And then they said that Mills confessed to them that he was there to engage in an ecstasy transaction with Donnell. So those are the three items of evidence that were attempted to be suppressed. The issue on the motion to suppress was whether or not there was probable cause for law enforcement to make this arrest of Mills. The only information that they had about Mills was what Donnell had told them immediately before this arrest, when they arrested Donnell and offered him the opportunity to cooperate.
And Donnell was a first-time informant?
Donnell was a first-time informant.
And they were meeting in a public place, and the purpose of their meeting wasn't disclosed on the phone?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And so the issue is, I don't believe the government's position is that Donnell's statement that Mills was engaged in this activity is enough for probable cause. I don't believe they make that argument since he's a first-time informant. But they allege that there's sufficient corroboration.
You know, I might have had a problem with this situation about the probable cause to immediately arrest him and search the vehicle, except for the fact that there is such a consistency in the way in which they built their case against all those other defendants, how fast all those other defendants flipped, that they all flipped under essentially the same circumstances, and so why shouldn't they think that Donnell was going to be the same?
Well, Your Honor, the response I would make to that is all of these other people were tied together. And that goes to another part of our argument, but all these other people were really part of a group of people that were distributing ecstasy. And Donnell was their supplier. So they were all tied together.
Well, Donnell was, there was evidence later found that Mills was in and around all of this activity as well.
Well, that's correct. There was.
If he didn't go to the breakfast meeting, the sales meetings or whatever.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I don't believe the consistency is sufficient corroboration because these other people, the police knew who these other people were. The police had other people's names even before a co-defendant flipped on them and brought them to the police. They had never heard of Mills because, and this really goes to the sufficiency argument, because Mills wasn't really part of this group. So the police had never heard of Mills from any of these other defendants. So that's why the consistency of the flipping doesn't, in our view, solve the problem of not having corroboration for this first-time informant. So essentially, that's our argument is that on the motion to suppress is that you can't rely upon Donnell's claim that Mills is coming over there to do a drug deal based upon the circumstances, and there really is nothing to corroborate that statement.
But he did he describe the car Mills was going to be driving?
I don't recall specifically, but that he may have described the car.
Well, the brief indicates something about Mills showing up in a black Mercedes as predicted or something like
that. Well, I believe that's correct, but there's no question that he knew Mills, because he did have phone conversations that law enforcement taped where Mills and Donnell made an agreement to meet at this shopping center. So there's no question that he knew Mills. The issue is there's no corroboration.
What time of day was this?
I don't recall specifically what time of day it was. But I think
I thought it was sort of at night, but that was the impression I had.
And Your Honor, I don't know that the time of day would corroborate the statement from Donnell either.
Well, you meet friends normally, you don't necessarily meet friends at 2 a.m. in a parking lot, not that I'm saying it was 2 a.m. We'll let the government defend that argument.
Okay. And if I can move on from there to the sufficiency. The sufficiency argument, it overlaps with the motion to suppress argument, because the indictment alleged a conspiracy among Donnell, Mills, a guy named Duffy, and about four or five other people. All of the people in this indictment, there were Duffy, Donnell, and three or four of these other people, they all testified in this trial against Mills. Mills was the only one that went to trial. But what the evidence showed was that this other group, everybody else, was part of a group of people who were jointly distributing MDMA in the Dallas area. Mills was not part of that group. So there's no question under the indictment. Even the DEA agent said Mills was not part of this group. Even Donnell, in his own testimony, said that everybody else was a group unto themselves and Mills was separate. So the indictment allegation of one overall conspiracy is not supported by the evidence as far as Mills is concerned.
But again, Mills was at the others of the co-conspirators saw Mills at Donnell's apartment, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And what the evidence would show in the light most favorable to the government is that Donnell was supplying MDMA to Mills. Donnell's also supplying MDMA to this other group. And so, but there's not a connection between Mills and the other group.
But can't you make an inference from the fact that Donnell was fronting the ecstasy to Mills, who couldn't afford the ecstasy, to say that shows there's evidence of more than a buyer-seller relationship under our precedent in United States versus Thomas?
Well, Your Honor, the facts are, as you stated, that initially that's how their relationship developed. And that is some evidence for the court to consider as to whether
there's some evidence. Don't we have to find it sufficient?
Well, Your Honor, the fact on the buyer seller question specifically, what our argument really is that even though there's evidence that Mills is buying ecstasy from Donnell, and even though there's evidence that Mills is distributing it elsewhere, there's not evidence that Donnell is conspiring with Mills for Mills' further distribution. Donnell has no interest in the further distribution by Mills.
Well, there's no exclusion. Well, he does have an interest if he's going to get paid.
Well, and that's no different than any other buyer-seller relationship.
Well, no, Judge Elrod said you either get cash or you get credit.
Right. So I don't think the fact that there's a fronting when their relationship begins means that it's not a buyer-seller relationship.
Well, but what about the Tammy Reed situation, that she was going to have Mills be the supplier at Club Iniquity?
Well, and that's just another situation where Mills is developing his own business to be the supplier at Iniquity.
I think you're taking buyer-seller. I mean, we just had an en banc in which we addressed buyer-seller a couple years ago in Delgado. Buyer-seller is not some sort of defense. It's simply that if all that we know is that A sells drugs to B, that doesn't make a conspiracy to distribute drugs. Because B could simply be a buyer of drugs for their own use, and that doesn't make them a member of this whole vast conspiracy. It doesn't go a whole lot farther than that. It doesn't mean that you have to show they all sat down and essentially opened up a grocery store for drugs and all agreed on some system where one guy would be the vice president and all that. If you're having this kind of relationship, I'm going to set you up as a supplier, I'm going to front you, I'm going to whatever, isn't that well beyond buyer-seller?
Well, it's well beyond traditional buyer-seller. I agree.
I mean, we didn't in Delgado say we wanted to broaden buyer-seller. We wanted to explain in cabin buyer-seller to explain that just any ordinary buyer of drugs doesn't become a member of a vast conspiracy simply by buying drugs. That's really the point.
Well, Your Honor, I don't disagree that that's what the case law, some of the case law has said. Our position is that Donnell has no interest in Mills' business once Mills buys the drugs from him. That's our buyer-seller argument. But
it's way stretching buyer-seller, isn't it?
Well, it's different than the buyer-seller.
I mean, you could say that in these vast distributions, if you're not going to count the credit, if you're not going to count the fact that repeat business benefits the supplier, then you would have to show he's getting a percentage to get past your buyer-seller. And we've never required that the distributor has to get a percentage for there to be a conspiracy.
And, Your Honor, I don't dispute that I'm asking the court to go beyond where the court necessarily has viewed buyer-seller in the past.
You know, Delgado, we went like this. You want us to go like that, and I don't see that we're in a position to go against an en banc decision that was.
Well, I don't view Delgado as foreclosing our argument. It may not support our argument specifically, but question.
What case does? What case says that you have to get a percentage of the sales of somebody you sell to in order for there to be a conspiracy?
I don't have a case that specifically says that, Your Honor. I think the main gist, really, of our conspiracy sufficiency argument is that Mills is just not part of this conspiracy. Mills is buying from Donnell. There's a buyer-seller relationship, but it's not part of this conspiracy.
Is this viewed under the plain error standard?
The buyer-seller portion of the sufficiency argument, that specific portion is probably viewed under the plain error standard.
Okay.
Most other portions of our sufficiency argument, I think the government concedes, are not under plain error.
Okay. Do you want to talk about the sentencing and whether it should be 24,000 pills or 120,000?
Our position on this sentencing is there's really two main arguments on the sentencing. One is that, and just to, as a little bit of background, what happened was Donnell, who was really the main guy in this conspiracy, made this deal with the government, testified against Mills. Prior to his sentencing, he fired his lawyer, filed a pro se motion to withdraw his plea, claimed he was innocent. Basically, everything he said in Mills' trial was not true because Donnell said he was innocent.
He wasn't involved, so he.
Right, he wasn't involved. So obviously, he's saying I didn't tell the truth in Mills' trial. So our argument on the specific point the court's asking about is that to rely upon Donnell's testimony to establish any sort of quantity is improper because he's certainly not a reliable source.
What's the difference in the sentence?
On the specific point where there was some question, I believe it was 120 versus 180, the court
rejected the 180. So
right.
The 180 is out the door. So
right.
We just have the 120 and the 24. What's the difference in the sentence between the 120 and the 24? Is there even any difference?
Your Honor, I can't recall specifically what the difference was under the guidelines on that. So I can't answer that specific question. If I could, though, what I would really like to address to the court on the sentencing argument is that, as the court can see, one of our points was that Mr. Mills was punished for exercising his right to a jury trial. And I understand this is an argument that has not gotten any traction in any of the courts of appeals.
So you want to make it again?
I want to make it again because,
in case we didn't hear you the last 3,000 times.
Right.
Okay.
But the reason I want to make it again is because this is a typical situation that occurs in the district court. Now, the district judge was careful to say, I'm not punishing Mills for exercising his right to a jury trial, I'm rewarding the other people for cooperating with the government. But that's just another way.
I mean, we would would be like going against thousands of cases if we said to the contrary. We said you can't reward people essentially for snitching.
Well, and I'm not saying that. I'm saying you shouldn't punish people for going
for
to trial.
For exercising their right to trial.
Exactly.
And the effect is if this guy gets a benefit and this guy doesn't, you can look at it as this guy getting a benefit and or this guy getting a punishment. We've said this guy gets a benefit. That's not a disparity.
It's all a matter of which direction you look at it. And the district
court guy sees it as a punishment, but this other guy sees it as a benefit.
And what I'm asking the court to do is to look at it from whether or not this does actually punish somebody for going to trial, where somebody gets half the sentence because they cooperated with the government.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, they had X amount of ecstasy pills, and that translates into Y amount of time, and the judge didn't. He didn't go outside the statute. He didn't go outside the guidelines, right?
That's correct.
So your fellow was sentenced in accordance with the guidelines, and that's a raw deal?
I'm arguing that he actually, in the context of this case, was dramatically punished for going to trial. I mean, that's the practicality of what happened
and
to him.
And perhaps that is the case, but we're not the forum for that argument, are we?
Well, that's what I'm asking.
But a very, very dramatic change, and that just, I don't see that you've really got the facts for it if we were ever inclined to go that way. That's my view.
I understand I'm asking the court to do something that this court and probably no other appellate court's done, but I'm asking the court to do it because I think the facts justify it.
Thank you. You have time for rebuttal?
Thanks.
Okay, Mr. Goodman.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Goodman. I'm with the United States Department of Justice, representing the appellee.
Say something, Mr. Goodman, before you get into whatever you were going to say. On the question of Donnell's motion for new trial, I couldn't find the motion for new trial in our record. It's obviously available to us in the other case, in Donnell's case. Are we permitted to look at that motion for new trial that Donnell filed in his case in order to gain an understanding of how that might or might not affect your case? Clearly, it was the same district judge, so obviously he had heard, I mean, he had it in his head. We don't have that, so that's my question to you.
Technically, you're correct. It is not part of the record in this case, but the government would not object if this court wanted to look at its court records in the related case.
Talking about this document, because you all have it, you're all talking about it. We don't have it. Can we go look at it?
Well, noted that it's not formally part of the record on appeal in this case, as I said, we would not object, Your Honor.
I mean, can we take judicial notice of it? It's a court record in the Eastern District,
of course.
Sure.
Okay.
The district court properly denied Mills' pretrial motion to suppress because the officers had probable cause to arrest Mills as he was about to engage in a felony drug transaction.
Now, would you please explain this, where this occurred and at what time of day?
Yes, it occurred in a parking lot of a Cinemark theater. It was between 9:30 p.m. and 9:45 p.m.
That's what I thought.
And it was, I believe, March 15th, 2010. There was probable cause.
They were going to originally meet at a Best Buy at 9:30. It would have been closed, and so they go to the Cinemark. Does that matter to the analysis? I mean,
they were going to a parking lot.
We're dealing with the argument that this could be innocent. I can call you up and say, hey, let's go meet. How about the Cinemark parking lot? And there's nothing nefarious about meeting in a Cinemark parking lot in and of itself. That's their argument.
Right.
So I'm trying to get at what are the totality of the circumstances that would make this event nefarious?
Okay. The totality of the circumstances include that Mr. Wilsey, one of the co-defendants, was going to meet Mr. Donnell earlier that evening in the same Cinemark parking lot to give him some money and obtain more ecstasy. The officers actually had arrest warrant for Mr. Donnell as well as Mr. Wilsey. When they arrested Donnell, they found a substantial amount of both cash and ecstasy in his car. They then recorded two conversations between Mr. Donnell and the defendant, in this case, Mr. Mills, in which they talk about where they're going to meet.
Nothing about drugs or money.
Pardon?
Nothing about drugs or money in those recorded conversations.
Not in the recorded conversations, although Mr. Donnell had said that they were that was the purpose for their meeting. He had told the officers upon his arrest that he was going to meet with Mr. Mills in a couple hours, and so the officers knew that. But it was not in the tape-recorded conversations themselves, Your Honor. That's correct.
So you believe that a tip of a first-time informant is adequate to support probable cause?
Well, again, it's not merely the tip of a first-time informant. It's the fact that the first-time informant has already been arrested, that he has ecstasy and a substantial amount of cash in the car. Then all the preceding events leading up to the arrest of Mr. Donnell, everything that they had the officers had learned had proved to be true. They had engaged in undercover purchases. They had obtained arrest warrants for the other members of the conspiracy. The conspirators had all pointed to Mr. Donnell. So as Judge Jones said earlier, the sort of cascading series of arrests gave them certainly probable cause, which is just a fair probability to believe that what Mr. Donnell was telling them was also going to bear fruit.
What's your best case for that?
Well, what I would emphasize as our best case is the fair probability standard, which need not even be 50%. Illinois versus Gates in the Supreme Court, or United States versus Garcia, 179 F3rd 265 in this circuit, because
I mean, in a fair, you know, is it any different here? They did put the cuffs on this fellow, and they did search his car, but would there have been any material difference if they just done a Terry stop of him? Because they'd have been allowed to frisk him, and they would. I'm talking about Mills. Once Donnell gave them the tip, they had every reason to believe he was going to meet somebody to pick up cash for a drug deal. But he comes into the parking lot exactly as predicted, gets out of the car. The police could have immediately walked up to him and said, "Hey, we're the police. We want to ask you some questions." In which case, they'd have been allowed to frisk him, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
They would have found a weapon.
Yes, Your Honor.
Immediately. And that alone could have given them probable cause.
Yes,
the rest of it. So, I mean, in a sense, there's no difference between the fact of the arrest and what they alternatively could have done.
Right. I would certainly agree with that if it had only arisen to reasonable suspicion, not probable cause, they could have done the Terry stop, particularly with the description of the car and exactly the place that it showed up. When they found the gun, when you add the loaded firearm to the other evidence that they knew, then they would have had the probable cause to search the car for evidence of contraband. You know, regardless of what Mr. Mills might have told them, that could have added to the probable cause. So I think that the result would have been the same. But as I say, I do believe that there was not nearly enough evidence for reasonable suspicion. I think it arose to the level of probable cause already at the time that they arrested Mr. Mills.
I mean, there wasn't any real doubt at this point that they had enough to arrest Donnell. His name had been coming up periodically, had it not?
Well, they had an arrest warrant for...
I understand that,
right.
But I mean, he was sort of fingered as the principal supplier of these people.
Yes, by more than one of the defendants whom they had also arrested at that point. Mr. Brown and Mr. Duffy, for example. With respect to the conspiracy, the evidence was clearly sufficient to show that Mr. Mills participated in a single conspiracy with Donnell and his other distributors, agreeing to sell Donnell's large shipment of ecstasy at clubs around the Dallas metropolitan area.
How do you dispose of 20,000 ecstasy tablets a month? In other words, let's say he's selling many of them to this ecstasy club, this iniquity club. What do people do with them? Do they take on, how many pills are they taking? That just seems like an incredible number of pills to me.
Right, and I think the evidence was between 10 and 20,000 a week at the height, and I think the evidence was that it was not only Club Iniquity, but other clubs as well, although Club Iniquity was the one that was mentioned for Mr. Mills and the one where he sold the most.
Some, like, vitamins every day or what? I just
don't. Well, my understanding from the record is that then Tammy Reed would, supply them in small quantities to the numerous people who showed up at the
What's an average quantity that a normal, I'll put in quotes, normal user would use, I think is the point. Is it one pill a night? Is it 10 pills a night? Is this like drinking beer? Is this, we're trying to get a handle on that. I don't have knowledge of it.
I'm afraid to say it's not in the record, and I don't have the knowledge to answer your question myself.
Is Reed indicted?
She was not in this indictment, Your Honor, and do not know whether there were federal or I tried to check. I didn't see any federal charges against her, but she was not part of this indictment. Could have been a local case, and I don't know about it, Your Honor. But I do think the main point is that Mills was far more than a mere buyer of ecstasy from Donnell, because he was not the end user. He was at least two levels down the chain. He was selling to Tammy Reed and perhaps other club owners who then distributed to their customers. And I think the large quantity involved with Mr. Mills, as well as the initial fronting of the drugs, helps to show that this does not fall into the Delgado mere buyer exception. And with respect to the single conspiracy, I think just the evidence that Mr. Mills with Mr. Duffy were sitting at Donnell's apartment at least four times, packaging together the ecstasy pills for the different suppliers of the different distributors for Mr. Donnell, shows that this was a single conspiracy. They were also not competing in the sense that they had divided the territories. If you were selling to one club, you weren't supposed to poach on the other person. So, Mr. Mills was doing a successful job at Club Iniquity and the other clubs where he was distributed. But he wasn't allowed to, take over territory of the Duffy or Brown or the other members of the single conspiracy.
Just exactly what is before us on the ordinary standard of review for sentencing? I think some argument was made that that part of that, at least, argument has to be reviewed on plain error. Or am I wrong on the quantity for sentencing purposes?
I think we did say plain error in the sense that initially Mr. Mills did not object to the drug quantity, but I will say that at the end of the sentencing he did raise that. We're content to have it reviewed under the normal reasonableness, abuse of discretion standard. Of course, his constitutional argument, which we do not think has merit, would be a legal question that this court could consider de novo to the extent that that is different from a substantive reasonableness argument. We do not think that there is any merit to that argument. We would point out that on the conspiracy count, Mr. Donnell, who did plead guilty, received 240 months. Mr. Mills received a lesser sentence, 188 months on the conspiracy count. It was only the 60 months for the gun that took him over Donnell's total sentence. And of course, as your honors have recognized, that had Mr. Mills pled guilty or cooperated quickly, he could have received departures for substantial assistance or for acceptance of responsibility and adjustment.
I would be surprised if we choose this case to blow up the entire way that the criminal justice system is set up. But
Thank you, Your Honor. And of course, we
who knows, right?
Point out that the district court did indeed sentence him at the very bottom of his advisory guidelines range.
All right, thank you. If you have nothing else.
I have nothing else, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Yudishin.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the motion to suppress on the Terry stop question, I don't believe that that changes the analysis, because even under a Terry stop, you have to have some type of reliable evidence to justify the Terry stop, and it still comes back to Donnell, and it still comes back to whether or not he's reliable and whether or not there's sufficient corroboration. So I think the analysis there would be the same. A couple of things that actually detract from the reliability of Donnell. Donnell is not just a first-time informant. He's a first-time informant who there are facts before the police that should give them reason to disbelieve him. Number one, he told the police that he was going to do a $6,000 tablet deal with Mills that night, but Donnell only had 1,000 tablets. So that should raise some red flags to the police. The police specifically were saying, give us somebody and we'll help you on your future sentencing. So that immediately is the sort of deal that should be raising some question about reliability. Donnell called and told them where to meet him at. There wasn't a meeting apparently set up where Mills was going to be at a specific place, so Donnell was not anticipating or predicting behavior. And just so the general circumstances should call into question Donnell's reliability. Donnell's and there was a reference to him receiving essentially more on the drug conspiracy than Mills did. But, of course, if this court looks at Donnell's record, you see that he went on and on and on with the judge in the process of trying to withdraw his plea, saying that everything he said was not true. And I think the district court rightly concluded that he had committed perjury either at his own sentencing or at somebody's trial. So I don't think that's the fair comparison between the sentencings. It's more of a comparison between Duffy, who was probably the number two person under Donnell in the actual conspiracy, and Mills. And just one final comment about the sentencing in general. The problem with this case and many cases is sentencing is no longer being based upon what the person did. It's based upon what the person does after they get arrested. It's based upon what the government says they did to help them, rather than having almost anything to do, in this case I think is a perfect example, having anything to do with who did what in the course of committing the crime. And
did the other defendants get 5K1 departures or what?
They all got 5K1 departures. And what the district court said was that his policy was to cut their bottom of their guidelines by 50%. And so they got good sentences, as opposed to Mills, who went to trial and got a bad sentence.
Well, you know, the government, in the interest of eliminating disparity could always file an appeal of a policy like that.
Well, I don't think they were dissatisfied with the sentences that the other people got.
Well, then they're asking for the disparities. It's very odd.
And to be clear, I'm not complaining about what the other people got.
Right, I know you are.
Okay, but we're back to the benefit punishment.
I understand. Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks a lot. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.